So today, the next few days, I want to discuss or read some things about some of the teachings of Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core. Particularly one work we like to address is called the Bhakti Trilogy, Delineations of the Esoteric Aspects of Pure Devotion by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core. There was some mentioning, I remember, in Vyasaki's book, which we hope all of you have read or are reading, Radha Damodar Vilas. He's written it so nicely, and it has such nice information about the earlier aspect of the movement, as well as he weaves in various aspects of Vaishnava history and some Vaishnava personalities. And he also mentioned some things about, in the earlier part, about Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, how Jiva Goswami trained Narottam and Srinivas and Shyamananda, and how these great powerful personalities represented the Vaishnava Siddhanta so wonderfully. And as history has shown, that there are times when there's a lot of confusion about just what is the proper activities, the proper philosophy associated with Vaishnavism. And we see how, in the time of Bhaktivinoda Kaur, how so much people thought that Vaishnavas were, that the Sahaja activities were the actual lifestyle arrangements of the Vaishnavas. Which is quite amazing, because the life of the true bhakta is so diametrically opposed to that of the lifestyle of Sahaja. Because it's real about mind and sense control and everything for Krishna, and selflessness, etc. But the platform of Sudha Bhakti, the Sudha Bhakti, is totally different from that of one who is literally engaged in sense gratification, rationalizing and justifying it, which is most unfortunate. It's one thing for people to be sinful, to not make the mark, and to recognize it, and to identify it, to not hide the situation. Someone is just falling. But when someone is engaged in fallen activities and trying to justify it as bhakti, that is most confusing. And that's why of so many things, the oneness of Sahajism was one of the most dangerous, because it's so close. So Bhaktivinoda, he did his part in having people to understand more about what is the proper position and activities of the Vaishnava. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core, also extremely did his part as well, as he became one of the more dominant Vaishnavas in Vrindavan. It was said that his commentary on the Bhagavatam, as he wrote it, that his devotion and his meditation and concentration was so intense that where he was doing his writing, that it did not even rain in that area. He was born, there's some dispute about his birth. Sometimes we find this, people cannot keep the kind of records that we now are supposed to keep, birth certificates, etc. So either 1576 or 1586, somewhere in that 10-year span, he was born. Just a little on the side, this book that Vyasaji has written, it can help us to appreciate so much more, as Prabhupada's biography written by Satsu Maharaj, and his wonderful book by Hari Sari. There's something interesting if you think about it. The early devotees, Prabhupada disciples ourselves, in one sense, the present devotees have more in terms of all the books are out now, so many books that Prabhupada was just writing at that time. And there's so much detailed information about what Prabhupada did, which in the early days we didn't have. And even hearing about Prabhupada, we heard about him, we were with him sometimes, but information did not travel quite as much as it can now. Or were things so consolidated? I mean, so much we can learn now as we read Prabhupada's biography, as we view the Abhaicharan series. So much we can reflect on as we read the Shikshamrita. So much we can appreciate as we have chance to talk with some of those devotees who did have those experiences. So if one has the proper greed, so much opportunity is there. Even I find that as I read such books as the books mentioned, how much it helps one to understand Prabhupada more. I have noticed in the last 5-6 years that I actually understand Prabhupada more from the God brothers and God sisters, even more than I understood some things Prabhupada did even when I was physically with him. And sometimes you can appreciate so many wonderful things about Prabhupada as different devotees have had even similar experiences, even certain events, but how it was appreciated, how it was reflected on in different ways, which brings so much. So for someone not to develop Prabhupada consciousness, that is just laziness, triflingness, because so much opportunity is there that we've all come indirectly or directly from Prabhupada's blessings. And so much literature is there to know about him, know what he did, what he said, now more than ever, as more and more devotees are writing their literatures and the Prabhupada Memorial Tape Series. It's very, very powerful. Hopefully we have those who've seen those, where different disciples are expressing very soulful things from their hearts and from their recollections. You put all those together, and we have so many wonderful ways to keep Prabhupada's message alive, to honor his vani like anything, and to practically tune into Vapu, because the devotees are talking about these personal exchanges and experiences. It is overwhelming. So how kind Prabhupada is that he left such a legacy, such an arrangement where the transmission can go on in such ways. And it's to go on not as something historical. Sometimes we make it only historical. What happened then, what happened then? No. What happened then, what happened even before Prabhupada? Because Prabhupada is not just a personality, but he is representing a powerful system that is about Krishna's personality. We must not make Prabhupada a cult leader, that he is just some great person, great spiritual person. No, he is very great, and he is so great because he is representing through his literatures, his purports, is a amalgamation of so many expressions of the great acharyas, along with his own realizations and his ecstasy. And what he gives us is so much based on his profound love of his spiritual master and trying to serve his spiritual master, based on how the chain of acharyas are trying to offer to Krishna. So we have this wonderful blessing that we are part of such a powerful paramparacha, evam parampara praptam, that this gives us a chance when we do things proper, how much we are blessed by that whole chain, how much those great personalities come out for us with their love and their benediction, their guidance, their well wishes. And how we do things that are improper, how much we are an embarrassment, a serious embarrassment, as these representatives are so exalted. As we were all having chance to share with and participate with the children, to see the powerful effect of the simplicity and innocence, not just children, but devoted children. Bhagavad Ramashadev had given Rajalila one book, which I borrowed or stole. Maybe I'll give it back, I'm not sure. But the book was I paraphrase the title if I don't get the title right. But it's The Children of the New Millennium. It's a very powerful book of one rather pious lady who had herself had a near-death experience, or several, I think maybe three near-death experiences. A lot of the book was talking about children who have come in this new time, and how many children who had near-death experiences, because she interviews children who had near-death experiences. So some died temporarily in the womb upon delivery. Some died from asthma. Some died temporarily. So many things. And were revitalized, resuscitated, etc. And it shares many powerful things that these children speak about as they talk about being aware of the experience, what was going on as they were considered to be dead or trying to be revitalized. Some of them discuss about their previous lives. Some of them had unusual types of, especially some of the new children now, unusual types of abilities and powers that, if not properly protected or cared for, then they'll just become acculturated to the normal scheme of things. In some cases, they were not so much understood, and what they had was not honored or encouraged. And in other cases, or people thought that they were just too much odd fashioned because of their insights and realizations, perceptions. So there is obviously unusual types of births taking place. Both polarities. And these children who are killing other children, we understand there's also some unusual births. The viciousness and greed that's there in a negative way. And some of the children that are now taking birth at this very unusual time in world history, universal or planetary history, means something very powerful is happening, that they have been now given chance to take birth, arranged by higher authorities, while such things are in motion. And so obviously some of them have a significant role in bringing in a new, real new age. Not this new age, it's still the old archetypes and paradigms. I was discussing with a nutriman, one or two leaders, the other day, as we were discussing issues about children. Because I write a lot of these social psychological themes, often I get letters from some of the children from all around the movement. And so, sometimes I was getting last year some, and the year before, especially when I had my spiritual warrior one that talked about certain metaphysical things. So, many of these kids are writing about certain dreams that they're having, certain experiences that they've had. And some of these dreams had to do, or these experiences, reflections, had to do with them having vision of their futures, as well as reflections from their previous lives. But what was most outstanding, some of the expressions of the futures, of what some of these kids see themselves doing in the future, when there is unusual type of chaos, pandemonium, confusion happening on the planet. So obviously every parent is thinking their child is special. And every child is special. Because for that parent and for their existence in the world, they're special. Every soul is even special. Because ultimately every soul is part and parcel of Krishna. But to the degree that we stimulate dormant consciousness, or the dormant consciousness has been stimulated sometimes in previous lives, then there's even some great, even greater special qualities that are there. This is one of the things we wanted to discuss with about Vishwanath Chakravarti, as we'll mention in a minute. But as we make one of the preface about Radha Damodar in relationship to the book and our discussion, I think as we read that book, we will even have a greater appreciation for their lordships. Well, the basic things, of course, of how Hare Krishna movement at ISKCON really started at Radha Damodar Temple. Prabhupada's special offering to the world really gets its real jump start there, as Prabhupada is sitting in the Radha Damodar Temple and as he is making many of his plans and projections before he comes to the Western world. And plus, so much of our backup about Krishna consciousness is based on what Jiva Goswami, Rupa Goswami have offered to the world. And how Radha Damodar deity is the deity of Jiva and of Rupa. I think also even our first sannyasi initiation, Kirtananda, was there at the Radha Damodar temple. And what to say of how even now we honor Prabhupada's rooms and we do puja there every day in service, as this is one of our main tirthas or pilgrimage places. And how we have this wonderful chance to be connected with this same lordship aspect of Krishna, Radha Damodar. I visited a few temples, several temples since Kartik, and as I was offering the candle, first I was looking for the Radha Damodar picture. Because everywhere in the world, people have to, they offer to the picture. And so I was looking, but then I remember, oh, here we have the actual deity. As I looked on this side, on that side, I was thinking, oh, for joy, we've got to put the picture up. Then I realized, oh, we don't have that picture here. We actually have the deity we can offer to their lordship in that, Archivigraha. So we hope we're all taking advantage of this period. One way we may want to is to reflect on the Radha Samavada Damodar's pastimes. We have time, we can make time to incorporate that into our reading schedule. I think we have several of Vyasaki's books still around. Devotees don't have them, please borrow, beg, steal, or get a copy. I think there's some around. It's a nice reflection and meditation during this Kartik period. And especially as we are reminded about what Prabhupada went through in trying to get this movement going, and what so many of his great servants have gone through and are going through in trying to maintain loyalty to Srila Prabhupada. And for many of us old-timers, hope he can help to revitalize us. Because at 19, 20, 21 years old, one has a certain zeal, physically, psychologically, etc. And this same kind of enthusiasm can be maintained as we try to enthuse our children more and then hopefully to maintain it. And how many powerful things unfolds in such ways. So, we want to look at Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, one of his presentations, the Bhakti Trilogy. Perhaps some of you have read it. I read it quite some time, I guess, when it first came out. And just less recently, I've looked over it again and just wanted to reflect on some of the things with yourselves. The first chapter is called The First Shower of Nectar. That is Madhurya Kandambini. Kandambini, Madhurya. Srimad Bhagavatam 10:43:17 states how the wrestlers all saw Lord Krishna in different ways. And so, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti emphasizes that how this statement clarifies that the gradual development of spiritual joy depends entirely on rasa and the degree of its intimacy. Therefore, rasa is a singular support for spiritual happiness and bliss. Even in our neophyte stages, we may find that we have a certain attraction to a certain deity over another deity, certain attraction to reading certain literatures over others, certain attraction to certain personalities over other personalities, certain appreciations that we, situations we find we are much more stimulated. Like some devotees, they get so surcharged that they read the Nisida Mahabharata. They feel a great sense of commitment, great sense of identity, great sense of value, etc. Other devotees, they find so much more solace as they absorb themselves in the Bhagavad Gita or Chaitanya Charitamrita or Nectar of Devotion. And hopefully some people, all of these. But this is also can have a lot to do with what is the actual eternal position of the soul. As the soul is there and it knows its ultimate alignment with Krishna. It's that the mind, the intelligence is not so aware or is in denial or interfering. And we see that many of these great acharyas that we often read about, that they have such special, ultimate relationships with Krishna. And sometimes their writings and their commission, their services, while in this material world, has some direct correlation with the mellow of exchange of service and love that they eternally engage in the spiritual world. The Lord and Suda Bhakti is self-manifested and independent. Sometimes it's a little confusing as we try to pinpoint what is really responsible for the bhakti. How is it controlled? How is it given out? How is it experienced? Srila Vishwanath explains, just as the Supreme Lord independently appears to the jivas by his own sweet will, Krishna is appearing in many, many different incarnations, many different leelas. So he explains, Bhakti Devi is also self-manifest. And also fully independent. And appearing in various places independently. So he explains that there's no difference between the Shakti, the energy or Bhakti Devi, and the energetic principle. Therefore, Srimad Bhagavatam, as we remember, and 1-6 states how the supreme occupational dharma for all humanity is that by which men can attain to loving devotional service unto the transcendental Lord. Such devotional service must be what? Unmotivated, uninterrupted, and to completely satisfy the self. So he explains that loving devotion is described here as being without any motive for personal gain. This establishes that bhakti is unfettered by calls or by conditions. So there's never any material obstacles that can check bhakti. Ultimately, we can procrastinate in many, many ways and not honor bhakti Devi, but it is not based on any conditional, material conditional situation. The major concern is how does the Lord bestow the bhakti? Does Krishna have favoritism? And so maybe he bestows the bhakti at a certain time, other times he doesn't. Does he bestow it on certain planets and certain universes and certain species and others he doesn't? Does he bestow it based on how we ingratiate him? No, none of these things. So then there are certain things that are mentioned to look at to see, is this responsible for the bhakti or another activity, mindset? Is it responsible? But first he explains in Bhagavatam 11:28, Yatra haya marhatatho jata shrahastu yaha pumam na nevino naisakto bhakti yoga swa sihaha. How bhakti is described by the word yatrit haya, or own volition. So, for example, one may ask, is bhakti due to pious activity? Is this how one gets the mercy of the pure bhakti? Or is it maybe the opposite? It has something to do with misfortune or impiousness? Or it explains that first bhakti cannot just be relegated to pious activities, because bhakti is not something karmakandic. It's not just controlled by what people may do based on some kind of business or some type of reciprocity dealing with externals, exterior, etc. Or bhakti is not something that comes from imperfection, impiousness. If something perfect cannot come from something imperfect, does not produce something that is perfect. Or is bhakti, Devi, is the blessing there based on action? Not exactly, because we see how different actions can produce different types of ultimate outcomes. It goes on to explain, it is certain that after much probing and speculation, a single and irrefutable cause will not be established. In the following, then he presents, just as the Lord's mercy is causeless, so his devotee's mercy is causeless. Just as the Lord's mercy is known to be caused, so his devotees who possess the same qualities as the Lord also shower their causeless mercy. Hence, when we declare that the devotee's causeless mercy is the reason which inspires bhakti, that bhakti is not being equally distributed. Naturally, this will be criticized. In other words, he's saying how Krishna, for instance, is called Bhakta Vatsalya. That it's considered that he seems to give special recognition to his bhaktas. But he does, but he doesn't. He doesn't really have favoritism. But we see that the bhaktas are receiving more. They're responding more. And that's the major word. They're the major concern. They are responding. They're more receptive. And so there is different endowment upon them because of their receptivity. So he then brings out how Srimad Bhagavatam 11:246 emphasizes how the Madhyam Adhikari, the devotee on the second level, how he offers his love to the Supreme Personality of Godhead in a sincere friend to all devotees of the Lord. He shows mercy to the ignorant, people who are innocent, and disregards those who are envious of the Supreme Personality of God. In other words, he makes distinctions. He makes distinctions between those who are favorably serving the Lord, in contrast to those who are envious. And so he relates to them differently. Then the question is, then is this not also a characteristic of Krishna and how he bestows the mercy based on making the distinction. This characteristic clearly identifies that the Madhyam Adhikari devotee does not distribute his mercy equally to everyone. The truth is that the Supreme Lord is subservient to his devotee. So the question is, if that is the action of the devotee, and if Krishna is subservient to the devotee, then Krishna must also make the distinctions, because he is bound to his devotee. His devotee wishes, the truth is that the Supreme Lord is subservient to his devotee's wishes. Therefore, he emulates his devotees in distributing the mercy. Based on this fact, it is easy to see that the Madhyam devotee is merciful to someone, that the Lord automatically showers his mercy on that recipient. The conclusion is what? The single cause that attracts the mercy of the Lord is the bhakti that permanently resides in the pure devotee's heart. Read that again. So the causes, look at the causes. Is the cause due to piousness? Is it due to impiousness? Is it due to action? In the verses in Bhagavatam explains, devotional service ultimately is not due to jnana, it's not due to tapasya, it's not due to rituals, it's not due to anything. But then where is it? Where's it coming? And so he begins to explain. In other words, Krishna's mercy will not be invoked without the bhakti within the heart of his devotee, which attracts his mercy to appear in the first place. Therefore, because bhakti is completely independent, even from previous piety and good fortune, it is indisputably confirmed that bhakti is self-manifest. So, as mentioned earlier, devotion is the only cause of devotion. Bhakti produces bhakti. Bhakti Devi does not require any cause or reason to appear other than her own sweet will. So, it's her own sweet will that she appears. She is eternally manifested in the heart of everyone, but eternally manifested, very pronounced, in the heart of the pure devotee. So therefore, bhakti is so much made available as it is locked up. Secondly, they are situated in the heart of the pure devotee. And so as Krishna allows himself to be bound by the love, as we are honoring Kartik, by the love of his devotee. So based on that reciprocity, that devotee is all for him, he is all for the Lord, all for the devotee, even to the point that he then fulfills the wishes of his devotee, who is in the unadulterated state. And so there is where Bhakti Devi is coming out, not based on other conditions. Did not discount only by, yes, knowledge and all these things are prerequisites, but they will not give us bhakti. Yajnas, havanas, austerities, rituals, bhajan, kirtan, following the ninefold process, all of these things, following the four wisdom regulations. None of these things will fully give us pure devotion. These things help us to do what? They help us to become candidates. We'll come back to that in a minute. In Bhagavatam 11:12:9, Yona Yogena Shakyena Dana Vrato Tapo Dravya Vyakya Swatyaya Sanyasye Pranuyat Yatna Vanapi. The devotional service cannot be obtained even by diligently cultivating yoga, empirical and deductive knowledge, performing charities, fasting, penitence, sacrifices, studying, and analyzing the Vedas, renunciation, etc. What are all these things for then? If this doesn't give us the pure devotion, then maybe this is impossible. No. But we see that it is the property of Krishna, it is the property of the devotee, the pure devotee of the Lord. Here one may present a counter-argument saying that devotees are always under the Lord's control. Therefore, how can the devotee's mercy appear first? So Krishna is being bound by the love of his devotee, He is roped by the love of his devotee. Bhakti is coming based on the devotee of the Lord, how Krishna is reciprocating to the wish, etc. But then, Vishwanath Chakravarti is saying, then one may present a counter-argument saying that the devotees are always under the Lord's control. Therefore, how can the devotee's mercy appear first? How is it the devotee's mercy seems to be dictating that of the Lord's actions when ultimately the Lord is over the devotee? Independently and not as a successor to the Lord's call is compassion. Krishna himself provides the solution to this problem by openly declaring that he is voluntarily subservient to this pure devotee. So Krishna is so powerful, so merciful, so compassionate that he allows himself to be controlled and his power to be under the wishes and jurisdiction of his pure devotee. This is a sign of great power. Sometimes someone has great strength and great power and expertise. They can only function under a certain way. And they can only function as they are in the controlling element. As they are lording over still in certain ways and they do something wonderful. But to put themselves at the mercy of other situations, they're not able to do. But Krishna's power is so consistent that he does not have to be served as the Aishvara. Matter of fact, he prefers not even to be honored in such a way. He does not have to be only understood and known as the supreme autocrat for his power to manifest and for him to pervade and to dominate overall. He does not have to worry about losing his grip by people not recognizing that he is the ultimate controller and annihilator and maintainer, etc. But the opposite. His power is so strong that he has so much greater appreciation when others are having power over him. He's even happier when the cowherd boys are sometimes defeating him even more than when he defeats them. He is even more happier sometimes when the cowherd boys jump on his back and they demand that he carries them, then he himself, who is controlling everything, even lifting Govardhan Hill, showing such power. So therefore, he is even more satisfied when the power is coming through that of his devotee, and he is more happy to have others to honor the power coming through that way. And therefore, he backs up the wishes of his pure devotee. And this is one of the many very exalted things about Krishna consciousness, why we have so much emphasis on the representative of Krishna. Why sometimes people become become confused. They see how, just as we're just honoring now, Prabhupada's disappearance, and devotees all around the world have been thinking more intensely about Srila Prabhupada. Jai Sri Sri Bala Damodaraji Ki. I was just getting some amazing emails and letters, emails and phone calls from some old God brothers who are trying to find ways to revitalize their Krishna consciousness. Because these special days, appearance and disappearance, they often have a way to really cause us to try to reflect more about what we are doing and to reflect more about what we promised and to scrutinize a little closer how much we are being consistent to those promises that we made before the Foundacharya, before some of the devotees, before the deities, to ourselves, to the sadhus. And so often, those times help us to begin to refocus, to recommit ourselves. So some of these calls of letters of people who are trying to find ways now how they can continue their offering to Srila Prabhupada, or ways how they can get out of their slump, or ways how they can capture that spirit of pioneering spirit that they had when they were 22 years old, 25 years old, or when they were doing this service or that service. And as we are all getting older, we realize more and more that, yes, we do not want to retire, but we want to have that spirit of Prasiddha Prabhupada represented as on his last days on his bed, he is still transmitting the message of the Bhagavatam. He is still sharing his own ecstasy and love and commitment to his guru, along with that with other of the great acharyas, and offering that in a special package that we can even be able to read and appreciate now. So we are those people who are to take that spirit of Prabhupada, that we are to die on the battlefield. Now the question is, what battlefield? But that is up to the individual. But we are to leave our bodies on the battlefield. And so that we find ways to engage either our body and mind, or perhaps both, but find ways to keep doing engaging. When Prabhupada's body was not able to be active, that still, his mind, whatever was there, he was offering in such ways. So this is what our the umbrella that we are all under. This is what our particular Foundacharya has given to us by his own example. That whatever is going on, find some way to glorify the Lord. Whatever is happening within oneself, within the environment, find some way to be able to use whatever energy is there, whatever facility is there, and being able to offer it back to one's guru, to Krishna. Where Prabhupada has stopped eating, he has stopped mating, stopped sleeping, and questioned defending, and he is in this situation, and practically all he has is little breath to speak something. He does not even have the physical strength to even hold the microphone. But he is giving. Huh? Where it can even barely be heard. The microphone is there, and he is speaking. So this definitely is a sign to all of us, for generations to come, that there is never a time and a situation where we are not able to somehow to glorify Krishna. As long as there is some breath, as long as there is some mental reflection, we can do that. Whether it comes to a point where we can only do it mentally, there's never a time where we cannot be able to use whatever is left there, that we give it back. Whatever we have, we find some way to give it. So, as we honor Prabhupada's disappearance all around the world, hopefully, more and more, we have reflect on how Srila Prabhupada has given and how we want to give in such ways. So last thing we offer from what Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti in the court saying, Bhagavatam 11:20-32 states that everything that can be achieved by fruitive activities, penance, knowledge, detachment, mystic yoga, charity, religious duties, and all other means of perfecting life is easily achieved by devotional service through loving service to me, Krishna speaking. So here again we see how literally everything is ultimately happening successfully because of the bhakti. Where there is sufficient jnana, karma, yoga, etc., is so much based on the element of bhakti. So therefore we see how bhakti produces bhakti. Everything comes back to bhakti. And how Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, the course, saying, and the way to really honor that bhakti is that the bhakti is locked up in the heart of the pure devotee. And so one has sufficient greed and eagerness to be able to catch up with that bhakti. So last thing, that there's sometimes, so that was just the first wave that we discussed. In the next few days we'll be discussing other Vaishnavas. But how wonderfully Krishna arranges that he has these special agents that constantly are appearing to make such wonderful things available. And how these things being available is now for us to embrace and for it to be an integral part of the culture of present-day bhakti on this particular planet. This is now as we are trying to honor our mission, our service to Prabhupada. So all these wonderful devotees who are writing their pastimes of Srila Prabhupada, speaking them on the tapes, writing the book, Prabhupada Lilamrita, the biography, the video series, the Vaicharan, etc. All of these things coming together help to give us very, very powerful presentation of this modern-day offering that is being given to the world. As we look at it closer and closer, and as we scrutinize it, we see that it is really Lord Chaitanya making it happen, and often in spite of ourselves. But Krishna is using his agents. Krishna can obviously do all this himself, but it is his desire to again show his power by how he uses others. Just as the teachers, they could have just done the Damodar prayer today. Okay, we're going to do an educational thing today. The teacher is going to do this. But how much more powerful as the teacher shows through what has been taught or how the students are being trained and makes the offering. Or how sometimes Srila Prabhupada would have big, big crowds of people. But instead of him speaking himself and giving the lecture, sometimes he would call on one of his disciples to speak. And not only did he call the men, but also the women. So when some of the devotees would speak, then how this would show Prabhupada's power even more. Not only is he such a great acharya, man, he has brought young people to Krishna consciousness, people from the West, people from different types of backgrounds, and now his power could be in his love and his and the effectiveness of his mission could be even more appreciated as some of the effects of that are shown. So, as Krishna honors, manifests much of his power through how he has it happening through his particular agents, which shows us even more. It gives us even more of an honest and appreciation. Our last issue is sometimes the conflict of understanding effort versus mercy. And we were having some reflection on that from the email recently. Mercy must be there, but mercy is also associated with effort. This is we're looking at what is really responsible for the bhakti. Is it pious activities or something connected with impious activities? Is it action? Is it certain deed? Is it certain based on certain favoritism? No. The bhakti is not bound by any of these things. It is not controlled by any of these things. While we look, we analyze, well, what about the mercy itself? How is it given? And do we just wait for it to happen? If mercy is causeless, then should we just wait for it to happen? And if it's based on actions, then how do we say that it's causeless? Then it is seemingly Vedavadavata or karma kandik, that we do certain things, get certain reaction. So then we may ask the whole question that is in the discussion of Nanda Maharaj. Then what is the need for worshiping Krishna? If it's all just based on these laws, then we just do the thing and we get a certain type of reciprocation based on what we do. We just engage in certain yoga, certain pujas, and we get certain types of results. And so what is the need for all this personal service to Archivigraha, the deity, the guru, the sadhu, etc.? Well, we must always act as if the ultimate result depends on ourselves. So we do our best in any endeavor. Well, at the same time, we must be aware that we're not the ultimate controller. So we act in the spirit that things do depend on us. And this is why such rasa like Vatsalya rasa is so powerful. even more over Santaras. This is why Vatsayaras is so much powerful, because here one is acting in the mood that Krishna is so much needing my service, that he is young child, and therefore he is so much in need that his existence is dependent upon how I care. So it's even more, in many ways, more dynamic than Sankhya Rasa. And so one is to act with that kind of commitment and dedication and absorption and intensity and attentiveness, as if the results are all dependent upon the person's actions. While at the same time realizing that Krishna is the ultimate controller. And so we do our best without claiming the ultimate proprietorship. We do our best with recognizing that there is ultimately a supreme controller and autocrat that we are trying to converge toward. Also, we appreciate that it is the effort that begins to position ourselves for the mercy. And we may wonder, well, then as we engage in certain things to get certain types of results, then how do we avoid accepting the results as ours? How do we avoid false ego, pride, puffed upness? When in fact we understand that it is our duty to have pride. How can we honor Krishna? How can we honor Prabhupada? How can we honor the great Vaishnava Acharyas if we do not have pride in them? How can we honor the Bhagavad Gita, the Bhagavatam, Hidantavya? How can we honor these things if we do not have intense pride in what they represent and what they give us? But there is the same pride that can be to one's downfall or can keep us in the material world. This is the nature of all the higher things of bhakti. It's called, in philosophy, we call it dayunato, when seemingly things are in opposition, seem to contradict. But all the higher things at first appear contradictory. But as they're studied closer, they give us different flavors, mellows, aspects to understand something in a more holistic way. They give us different some variety of something that is of a greater nature as it comes together to understand and appreciate it. So the devotee is to have that intense pride. Otherwise, we'll be embarrassed, we'll be intimidated, we'll not take full advantage. We think that, oh, it's just another book, another religion, another philosophy, just something relative. So let everybody do what they can do and honor what they can, whatever helps people to feel good, and that is okay. No. This is not what the great Acharyas have given us. But they themselves have this tremendous humility, and at the same time, this tremendous pride. Rupa Goswami represents it in this Ashabandha prayer. Well, he's distinctly saying, I have not this kind of achievement. I have no love for God. I don't have love for the things that help one to develop love. I'm not having this boon, that boon. But at the same time, I have this complete conviction that cannot be wavered. This complete conviction that I will get the mercy of the Lord. This complete conviction in my pride in appreciating Krishna's causeless mercy, and knowing that causeless mercy is also available for me, and that I will align myself to be able to receive that mercy. So we are to not to have the pride in our own achievement, but as we do work, as we do achieve, but we have pride and respect for Krishna coming through. We have pride and respect for what Krishna's agents have arranged. And we have determination, and we put forth great effort. And where there's even success in that effort, we must be careful that we work as if it depends on us very intensely, but at the same time, we offer the results to the Lord. So this is the power, great power of bhakti, of how bhakti works. Maybe an example is someone is in a well, and they're somewhat in prison. They have trouble trying to get out. Someone comes by and throws down a rope. Now the person grabs the rope, and from the rope they pull and they're able to get out. So now that person has achieved. But for the person to think, it is by my wonderful power of how wonderfully I grabbed that rope that is due to my success. Yes, effort was there. The person had to grab the rope. But it was the mercy that is most dominant. It was the mercy of someone putting the rope and now the person grabbing and becoming able to get out based on the cause's mercy that was extended. Now the mercy was extended and the person staying in that well did not get out of that well just because the mercy was delivered. The mercy was delivered, the rope could just be there dangling. But the person has to put the effort to grab hold to the rope where the mercy is given, and now the effort with the mercy produces the success, produces the achievement. So Krishna and his agents, they give the mercy, but they don't do it for us. Krishna could have defeated everyone in the battle of Kurukshetra. Could have did so many things in many, many cases. But often he is arranging that mercy comes to his agent. And he is arranging that even when that mercy is there coming from him, coming from his agent, that now one has to produce and one has to engage in certain efforts to be able to connect with that mercy. And this is a causeless position. It is causeless. It is not based on favoritism. Even though there is the bhakti vatsalya that one is receiving more. But it is now how we hold on, grab on. And then once we grab on, we must be careful that we keep the identification that of giving the honor to the mercy. Otherwise, even though there may be one success by grabbing onto the rope that time, but then one is thinking that they are the achiever, then the next time there will be failure. Or they will be bypassed from getting the mercy. So rope is extended. So Prabhupada has extended the rope. It was extended on and on from previous acharyas. So that rope is constantly being extended. Then the question is, do we just analyze it, and do not grab hold and begin to experience it? Do we throw it back and consider that it's too difficult, consider that it's not worth it? Do we get too distracted and we forget about the chance to rise above? So many, many things are there that can interfere and intervene if we are not understanding the effort, need for effort, and also the position of mercy. One can just feel defeated, completely defeated. I'm here now, I'm stuck here, and just die. Sometimes people do like that, and just die, because they're difficult. But mercy is always there. And when the mercy comes, as it is causes, it is not coming just based on knowledge, not based on austerity, not based on jnana. It's not that now I'm going to chant this mantra, I'm going to make the mercy come. No. But the mercy is available, and it is causeless, and it's extended. But the question is, as it reaches us, then what is the quality of our effort? And once we are connected with, then how do we honor so that it continually comes in our life? Otherwise, mercy comes at different times. If we do not honor it properly, then we'll find that it seems to stop coming. Because Krishna's promised that we surrender his rewards accordingly. And he's let us know through his great writings like what Srila Vishwanatha has given us, is how it is locked up in the heart of his devotee. And how Krishna purposely enjoys more letting his power manifest through his agents even more than through himself. For where there's not proper, healthy sadhu sangha, then there'll be difficulty in the emergence of that mercy. Where there is too much fixation on one's own abilities, then the mercy will be missed. And the converse of that, where there is a lack of appreciation about the power of mercy, then one will not bring the effort. One will just think that the mercy is supposed to descend upon them, and that is supposed to be it. And so once the rope is thrown, then one is wondering, why am I still in the well? Well, you have to grab it. And as you grab it, then it's been extended to you. Now you can pour yourself out. And then the proper mindset is giving so much appreciation, for the rope being given by the carriers of the mercy. So we will be discussing this for the next couple of days. Some of the offerings of Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, as we try to focus more on this Kartik period and rejuvenate or stimulate ourselves of Prabhupada's wonderful presentation to this world, and how we remind ourselves that we are part of such a powerful umbrella. And as we do something that is proper, then how we are being received and loved and blessed by that wonderful Prabhupada transmission. And as we have some stagnation, or as we minimize the mercy of the rope, then how we slow down being able to achieve, or as we say often, how we cheat ourselves. So mercy is there. Now the question is how we grab it and move quickly to the level of acceleration, etc. Hare Krishna. Any questions or any comments? Reading from the Bhakti trilogy, the delineation and the exoteric aspects of pure devotion, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti.
Thank you, Gurudev. At the beginning of the class, you were saying how someone may have attraction to certain deities or books or something along this line. Now, is that in all cases somewhat a sign of some deeper connection, or sometimes can it be on like a shallow plane based on some material conditioning and thus it'll change after some time?
It could be all of those and more. It could be just based on ego. Somebody says, well, the Bhagavad Gita, I don't read Bhagavad Gita. This is for neophytes. You know, I only want to read the very, very sweet pastimes of Krishna and Vrindavan only. Somebody thinking, oh, the chant rounds, do regulated activities. No. This is for neophytes. No. I simply want to express my innermost, coremost love of Krishna, and he's expressing that through me, etc. So it may just be something pretty artificial, also, of a certain mellow that one is trying to think to serve in. Or it can be something that is shallow, and that can distinctly change. Someone may, at this state of one's evolution in Krishna consciousness, feel, oh, I really admire the cowherd position, cowherd boy, of being able to wrestle with Krishna. Huh? And as that person unfolds in consciousness, they may find distinctly that their ultimate association and their real taste in mellow is being able to be a assistant of some aspect in Madhurya. Where while there is more of the material personality, which is having to do so much with still a lack of real identity and surrender, one may think, yes, I really would like to wrestle with Krishna so I can beat him. and so they're more in that mood of reflecting on such. But that, you know, necessarily something is coming from the opposition of their the original swarup. But sometimes it is. Any other questions?
It sounds like, you know, if you want to put it down into like simple words, he's saying it's more important who you know than what you do. In other words, sometimes, you know, somebody might be extremely qualified for a job, say, for example, and he studies, he's going to all the nice universities and stuff like that. But still, he might have an in. He might know the father of the man who's doing the hiring, or the uncle or something. So therefore, it's more important who you know than what you do. And so in some way, someone may make the argument that sounds like patently unfair. So I was wondering what you would say to that.
There's a lot of truth to that. As there different types of, so say, personalities representing different types of religious activities? Definitely according to who you know. You may know and be aligned with someone who's teaching impersonalism, and so they're connected with such, who you know, may align, be aligned with somebody who's teaching about, you know, how to engage in karma kundalini things, so it's who you know. But who you know, and then even amongst Vaishnavas, about who you know, but who you know is also in concatenation with Sukriti, Jnana Sukriti, from credits from previous lifetimes, efforts from previous lifetimes, credits in the present life, efforts in the present life, along with mercy. That will also distinguish who you know and how you know who you know. Because many people get the mercy through various credits and ultimately through mercy to know Srila Prabhupada. Then the question is also, and that is very special, but then it's how you know. Some people knew him and that they were around in the early days. They never took initiation and they knew him in a certain way. People knew him and they took initiation. So he left the planet, they left. So the question is also who you know and how you know, etc. So all those things are there. Any other questions? Yes.
I want to thank you. Welcome. You were talking about pride, devotees having pride in the in Srila Prabhupada, having pride in the Shastra. And you also warned about pride being a cause for fall down sometimes. Would it be correct to say another way of looking at this pride is that the devotee is not having pride in himself, but having pride in the Shastra means that is dovetailing pride to Krishna consciousness. Would that be?
No, it means really being genuinely proud of the wonderful scriptures we have, genuinely appreciative and proud that somehow Krishna has arranged that we have come under this great founder, Acharya Srila Prabhupada, having genuine pride, these wonderful pastimes that Krishna has, that we can have a chance to honor God. He said, not as this in his ice flower, not only as the great controller, but in so many, many wonderful expressions, so many, many wonderful exchanges. As we were discussing, you know, this Kartik period, asking all devotees to intensify their basic mood of appreciation. We carry that on into the Thanksgiving period. So we just try to focus more. And that means not just a whimsical reflection, but being genuinely happy, stimulated, exhilarated, motivated, and proud to be able to engage in the process of devotion. But not proud of what we individually do based on our intelligence, and then feeling so much captured by false ego and seeing ourselves as a controller or as a proprietor. So the danger is that when it stops with ourselves. And the danger is if it doesn't go. We don't have pride. We'll not have enthusiasm. We'll not have commitment, firm faith and determination, etc. I mean, people who minimize how powerful that this Vaishnava Siddhanta is, they'll never catch up with it sufficiently. Because they'll think, well, I'll do a little Krishna consciousness now and maybe a little bit of this Hatha Yoga later, a little bit of Kriya Yoga, and I'll be with this guru now and that guru, and I'll be with this system and that system. Some people like that. You know, they think Krishna consciousness is another one of the smorgasbord of activities. Or they think, well, that was wonderful, and when I was in my youth, I really needed that. But now, I mean, you know, I'm a mature adult now, and I don't have to need this idea of, you know, personal God and, you know, rules and regulations and institutions and all these things. So we want to take it away from ourselves in both categories, but at the same time to ecstatically embrace the power and the love that is given to us by Krishna and his servants. We don't want to be in denial, thinking that we're responsible, or in denial of the power of that love. Any last question?
Guru Maharaj, you were talking about mercy And we know that the mercy can come in very positive way, or it could come in seemingly adverse ways. And also that devotees, once you take initiation, you're free of karma, but the fan is still running. So how do we see, how do we differentiate the adverse things that happen to us on the path of devotional service? Is this mercy? Is this karmic reaction? Do we need to have a positive outlook, or be more realistic about where we're at in terms of what we're receiving from our past activities?
It's like the idea of the fan. Something is going on, very powerful. You may slow it down, but it's still powerful. It's still having some effect. So sometimes we have so much stuff, that even though there's some alteration in initiation, there's still so much other stuff that we're still carrying. There's some patterns that we're still stuck in. But we started the fan, moving again, pretty fast. But again, a similar mood. The devotee accepts any adversary as their fault, that they deserve even more. At the same time, they honor the fact that as Krishna is not making any mistakes, that for some reason he has allowed, some good reason, he has allowed these things to be part of the person's field of activity. And that's where the humility and the great appreciation and recognition that Krishna is in fact our well-wisher. See, otherwise, if we dive into that too deeply, adversarial conditions, then it means later we have to start blaming Krishna. Because he's the one really controlling it, ultimately. We realize that, yes, Krishna is honoring our free will. And with our free will, we're doing different things. We're getting different reciprocations based on that. So, we take any difficulty as our fault. We blame ourselves. Or we look at it and think that we deserve worse. But at the same time, we are acting in a way, trying to get Krishna's mercy with our effort. Otherwise, people even run away from God, from the spiritual path, because they're thinking that a spiritual path means now no difficulties. No. There's nothing more difficult than being on a spiritual path. To be on a spiritual path means that you are in a material world, in a material body, living with material culture, and you're saying, the hell with all of that. To the extent that you're saying, you're not making any of that your priority when the material environment is about material priorities. And so that means you're going so much against the grain. So how is there going to be just peace when you're going against the grain? Even sometimes ignorance produces more sense of peace than when you start dealing with the reality, start developing knowledge and wisdom. So this is all part of the mindset, really, of the cheaters who address religion as something just about peace. Because the cheaters, to a certain extent, are still trying to use God, use religion, for arranging for their desires, their material desires. Arranging to have things removed as interfering with their material desires. So therefore, they're looking more for peace than service and ultimate association. But for us, we want ultimate association and service. So therefore, this is difficult as we move the things away. God needs time to stop. So this is more difficult. So we just end up realizing that as we take the spiritual life, that we expect all of these things. We have to look closer at just what is bhakti and how bhakti comes, how to honor it in such ways. But realizing that behind it all, the mercy is there, and the effort must be there also. ISKCON found the charge of Sri Prabhupada ki. Sri Srivara Damodara Vala Kala Chanji. Jagannath Baladev Goni Tai ki.